Medical science is scrambling to keep up with the speed and intensity of the COVID-19 outbreak, and so is our public health care system. Every day brings new reports of infection and government efforts to slow the spread of infection. In fact, we're awaiting the decision this morning by Governor Kate Brown of Oregon on whether to close bars and restaurants in the state. Schools are also shut down for at least 2 weeks in Oregon, public events being canceled or postponed, and officials are stressing that vulnerable people should stay home and avoid contact with others whenever possible. In fact, Governor Gavin Newsom of California has ordered bars and nightclubs closed in that state. Dr. Chunwei Chi runs the Center for Global Health at Oregon State University and is a professor of health management and policy in the College of Public Health and Human Sciences at OSU. He joins us this morning. Dr. Chi, thank you for making time in what I'm sure is a very busy schedule these days.
Well, good morning, John. It is my great pleasure to be able to be interviewed with the NPR.
Thanks for joining us. So by now, pretty much everyone knows that this virus originated in China, but the original assessment, which was made with some authority at the time, that it originated in a particular so-called wet market in Wuhan in mid-December, seems to be undergoing some revision. I read an article over the weekend published in the South China Morning Post, which is the English language newspaper in Hong Kong. It says that Chinese scientists may have found a so-called patient zero who had the virus as early as November 17th. So what have you seen that is new information about the virus?
Well, there has been a lot of dispute about the origin of the viruses. And I'm actually, even before the report of the South China Morning Post, I have been suspected the cases could have been broke out in November for one good reason, because two Chinese research team, including their CDC researchers, they published several articles, including the most top medical journal in Lancet and New England Journal of Medicine, around January 23rd. And in each case, in the meta section, they said they collected 450 cases of patients. And more than half of them were collected in December. So they started collecting those cases in December. Normally, we would not initiate a study unless something already happened. So ever since they published that paper, I started to suspect the cases must have been around in November. Otherwise, they would not conduct that study.
And so what key things do we still not know about this virus? It seems there's a tremendous amount that's unknown still.
Yes, and especially about the true origin, whether it's from fish market or from the lab, and that is still under dispute. And we are also learning more and more, and every day we learn new knowledge about this virus, but still a lot of unknown. Because this virus is probably one of the most complex, most tricky virus we ever encountered, because it can easily masquerade as something else and misdiagnosed.
And is that what led people early on to say, oh, yeah, this is like the flu?
Yes. One of the reasons many people mistakenly thought it was like the flu was for about 60 to 80% of people who infected, their symptoms will be similar with flu. But for the other 20%, they will be very severe, from lung failure to death.
So, by the way, we're talking with Dr. Chunwei Chi. He's the director of the Center for Public Health at Oregon State University this morning. You can join the conversation. Unfortunately, our audience phones are not working correctly this morning, but we can take emails. You can email your question to jx@jeffnet.org, and we'll try and ask that for you. So, Dr. Chi, it seems to me that what we're seeing in the United States is a public health crisis smashing into a privatized healthcare system. How do you view what we're going through right now?
Well, this is the kind of crisis no private healthcare system can deal with it. And as you have seen, the president and the Congress has appropriated over $8 billion to address this. And one of the earlier barriers why we were not able to identify more cases, partly with the defected testing kit from CDC, partly because it was privatized, and the cost for testing this in a privatized healthcare clinic cost about over $3,000. And even with insurance, in early on, the copayment can be as high as $1,000. So that was a big barrier. But now we removed that barrier with this funding that everyone can test it for free.
So let's talk about testing. I mean, we keep hearing from Washington that 1.5 million more tests are on the way, or, you know, pick a number. And yet the numbers are very worrying about how many tests have actually been undertaken in the United States. We hear that South Korea, for example, has been testing 10,000 people a day, and I'm not sure we've even reached 10,000 total tests in the entire United States.
Yes, that's also one of my concerns. From January to the end of February, the whole country, the U.S., was grossly under-tested. Up till the end of February, the whole country only tested about 472 cases. And my rough estimate, the number we should have been testing in that 1.5 months period is at least 100 times of that. Had we done that, we most likely won't be in this crisis now. But that's the things of the past. And so to compensate that, I highly recommend we do more aggressive testing. But that is easy said than done, because every state, the state health agency, kind of overload. And so besides aggressive testing, it needs to come with funding, with additional staffing, additional facility. For example, what do you do once you identify more cases? How do you isolate them? And for those contact, how do you quarantine them? And I think we are just in the crisis mode, try to amend this. Most states are not prepared where and how to isolate or quarantine either the confirmed cases or the potential high-risk contact that need to be quarantined.
So I spoke last night with a physician who's in clinical practice in Central Oregon and is not approved by their clinic to speak to the media, and so I cannot identify this physician. But this doctor told me, and this is a direct quote, there are no tests. So if a patient comes to this doctor today with a suspected case of COVID-19, the doctor has no clear way of ordering a test. What is holding up the testing?
That has been a mixed message, because some clinics or hospitals claim that anyone who are at high risk or need to be tested can be tested. So I don't know exactly what happened, because since the appropriation and also declare a both national and state emergency, there are supposed to be far more funding available. And with those funding come with not just the testing, but also the money to hire extra staff. After all, this is a crisis, an emergency, and we need to treat it seriously, that every state need to beef up its staffing by hiring additional staffing to help both screening, testing, and following. One thing we haven't done aggressively is once we have identified a confirmed case that is from community spread, the definition of community spread means someone who infected without known sources. And that is a big concern. So we have to aggressively track, follow whom these confirmed cases has been in contact. And then we need to screen them. If possible, those with more intense contact need to be tested.
So can you help us understand the logic of the testing criteria? Because as you mentioned, there's definitely documented community transmission of this disease in the U.S. And it seems like the current guidelines that we keep hearing about is that testing is available if a patient shows symptoms and has either traveled to a hotspot recently or has had direct contact with someone who isn't already a known case of COVID-19. And this is where the logic, I'm having trouble understanding. The public health community acknowledges that there is community transmission going on in the U.S., which means that we are now a hotspot, or at least places like Seattle, New York, and Boston currently are. So how do those criteria even make sense anymore?
My understanding and assessment is those criteria are too conservative. given that we are in hotspot and we also are way behind in terms of preparation. For example, Taiwan, Singapore already in full-scale prevention in mid-January, and we are nearly 2 months late. And so we I think it's too late to take the measure like that Taiwan and Singapore did. And to compensate that, we need to be more aggressive in testing if we want to slow down or stop the dramatic outbreak like what happened in Italy. And so, for example, I have been highly recommended to loosen up the criteria of testing, particularly given now it's a flu season. So anyone with flu symptom, they need to be ruled out it's flu. And if they're being tested, it's not flu, then they should be tested.
Okay, you mentioned Singapore and Taiwan, and they both those countries have been given praise for limiting the spread of COVID-19 in their countries. What did they do that was so successful?
They did a lot, because the reason they are so successful was both countries suffer seriously from 2003 SARS. So both countries have been prepared for this since 2003. And of course, they have all new guidelines, new procedure, new facility. For example, negative pressure isolation room, they dramatically increased them. But they also were one of the common scene is both countries doesn't trust information from either WHO or from China, because again, China also covered up this whole epidemic, and WHO helped China to cover up. And one of the factors make these two countries success was they did not trust those sources. They trust their own sources. And in addition, both countries started screening or onboard inspection of passengers from China early on. Taiwan was the first one in December 31st. Taiwan started to onboard inspection of all passengers from Wuhan to Taiwan. And also, one of the success for them is early planning, early deployment. For example, Taiwan banned export of medical mask, as early as January 24. And then Taiwan normalized all masks that they can only sell to the government, Minister of Health, and then government, Minister of Health, prioritized to all clinic, hospital, and health professional, and then ration to individuals. Initially, the rationing was 2 pieces per person per week at a very low price of 35 cents. And then another strategy they did was, again, in January 30s, invested $6.8 million to build 60 new production line of masks. And that magically completed in early March. They started to produce. So in January, Taiwan was producing 1.8 million masks per day. Now Taiwan is producing 10 million per day. And so they expand the rationing number. Now every people... A citizen raised in Taiwan, they can buy 3 pieces of mask per person per week, and children can buy 5 pieces. And so Taiwan is probably the only place in the world that people don't have to worry about masks. Also, I want to talk a little bit about masks. There has been some rather incorrect information about masks, saying many public figures and health authorities saying don't wear masks and masks won't protect you. And I think that's not a very correct information. The correct information is wear mask alone does not protect you. You also need hand hygiene and all other practices. At the same time, there will be occasion where people need to wear mask. So for example, you've probably seen the video footage that in many international airport, people lined up in a very crowded space to pass through inspection. And that's a hot ground for spreading the disease. Those people should have wear a mask in that kind of close contact.
So what you're saying then is if you might have the virus, you might be in a situation where even if you don't know you have the virus, but if you do, you might spread it, then you should be wearing a mask in that case if you're say, packed in a line at an airport with a bunch of people.
Yes, yes. But not just for people who are suspected or might have been infected, but also, for example, anyone who otherwise are healthy, who have to go to clinic, go to hospital, they have to wear a mask. And in Taiwan, they require every student who entering school have to wear masks. After nearly 2 months, Taiwan still remain opening all public places and restaurant, bar, and schools. All schools remain open, but with very strict guidelines. They measure everyone's temperature entering the campus, and they spray your hand before you enter the campus, and then you have to wear a mask to be allowed to enter campus.
Our guest this morning on the Jefferson Exchange is Dr. Chun-Wei Chi. He's director of the Center for Public Health at Oregon State University. We unfortunately can't take phone calls this morning because our audience lines are not working, but we can take your emails. And I have one here from Lee in Eugene. And Dr. Chi, Lee asks, how long can the virus live on dry surfaces, cold or warm, inside rooms or in the outdoors?
It varies because depending on the nature of the surface, depending on the temperature. So far, it has been documented ranging from a couple of hours to up to 9 days. So that's the range. And I have multiple sources indicating the virus will be rather inactive, not killed, but inactive at around Celsius 27 degree. And that's about close to 90 degree. That's when the virus will be inactive. And the virus will be killed at 56 Celsius.
At 56 Celsius, so that's that's very warm.
Yeah. But it will be rather inactive at close to 19 Fahrenheit. 90, I'm sorry.
Okay, so when you say inactive, does that mean it's not able to infect a host?
Yes.
Okay. We have another email here from Noah in Eugene. Noah writes, the United Kingdom government has controversially considered achieving herd immunity, which entails exposing at least 60% of the population to the virus. To the best of your knowledge, has a national government ever deliberately managed exposing its population to an infection for the sake of maximizing immunity?
Not that I know. And yes, that has been in the debate within the academic field as well. I have read so many debates over the weekend. And the controversy is, one of the things we don't know is how long the immunity lasts. Because so far, both Japan and China has cases showing people who are cured but then reinfected. And so, because we know so little about this virus, and on top of that, this virus continue to mutate. So if, say, you reach the herd immunity, but then there's no guarantee the population will continue to immune against a mutated virus. But more dangerously, so personally, I have great reservation, if not criticism, of such policy, but this is still subject to debate. One important issue of exposing people, particularly young people. So their strategy is, okay, the elderly people, 65 and older, are more vulnerable, so you stay home, we protect you, and then the young people, you just get exposed. But even young people have been shown in Italy, in China, in Japan, of dying from this disease. So young people, young healthy people, they are not totally immune. And one of the important mechanisms that many researchers are eager to find out, they're researching to find out, is how can we prevent, once a person is infected, how can we prevent that person progressing from severe condition, severe symptoms? Because in the severe symptoms, you may need all the equipment to respirators, and you will have a lung failure, and the worst case is death. So until we know how to prevent that progression, right now we don't know. I think that's a very risky policy to implement, because you don't know who will end up very severe, either dying, end up dead, or have a permanent damage to their lung. And this could happen to anyone across the age group.
And so as we get back to public health policies in the United States, we just have a few minutes left for this segment of the show. Is the only hope for slowing this virus spread down a complete shutdown of the United States?
I hope we don't have to go there, but in order not to go there, we have to really beef up our current testing, tracking. One of the key in order to avoid lockdown, well, the reason you have to lock down, to shut down, is because the inability or unwillingness to aggressively tracking patient. Singapore and Taiwan has been doing that very aggressively. And for example, Taiwan so far has only one death. And for that one death case, the government tracked more than 350 people and tested 145 people and also quarantined 60 physicians and nurses. And that's how aggressive Taiwan has been in keeping this virus contained. And that's why Taiwan still keep all school open and all public places remain open. People still going to restaurants.
But does Taiwan have a single public health system?
Yes, Taiwan has a universal healthcare system, and that has been totally integrated under the Ministry of Health and become an important part of the so-called weapon fighting against these viruses. So back to your question, in order to prevent the necessity of total lockdown, as many European countries are doing, Italy, Spain did, is the alternative is we take this seriously. If we want to avoid total lockdown, we take seriously and allocate far more resources into containing it, that including more personnel and, if necessary, mobilize military personnel. Taiwan mobilize military personnel to participate the shortage of staff, and that is a possibility. Aggressive tracking, aggressive testing, and strict isolation and quarantine. That's the method to contain it. And the other alternative is lockdown.
Okay, so when let's assume that in the next week we're finally able to get a lot of testing out, and we have very little time left on our segment, so this is going to be a quick answer. I'm curious about this. Do private labs have to report positive results to the CDC?
They should.
They
because
should.
CDC need to know who and how many people are infected. And Taiwan make this information public, but they keep a personal identity private.
That'll have to do it for today's segment. We've been speaking with Dr. Chun-Wei Chi. He's the director of the Center for Public Health at Oregon State University. A lot of very valuable information. Thank you, Dr. Chi, for taking your time to be with us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Can I say one more message? It's very important to sustain our healthcare system, protect our physicians and nurses. This is a high priority.
Absolutely. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.